We believe we have, I don't know if he needs to be officially appointed, Rick Hansen as an ex officio member, since he's the one of the House appointments to the Lessard Commission. So he gets to sit and talk and allegedly not vote. But anyway, we have two. Going to try and govern the time a little bit better than I have before. So we're starting with the legislative auditor's report on conservation easements. I will point out, I don't know how many other committee members need extra reading material, but these are legislative auditor's reports on every part of the of our committee's work. And I have them, and I'm sure you can get your own private copy of them if you want them, or you can find them online or anything like that, or you can come and borrow mine. But we'll continue. We'll start with the legislative auditor, and then hopefully I'll govern the time a little bit better than I have before, and we'll get to the issue of the musicians and music support. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Judy Randall, who is an evaluation manager in the Office of the Legislative Auditor and was the manager of our evaluation of conservation easements. I would also like to acknowledge, Madam Chair, if I might, that we also invited members of the Legislative Audit Commission to be here as well. Representative Hansen is, in fact, a member of that. I believe that I know that Representative Falk is. I don't believe he's a member of this committee, so he is here as a member of the Legislative Audit Commission, and I certainly welcome their presence.
Okay, I certainly welcome any members of the Legislative Audit Committee who are here to come sit at the table, too, if they would like to.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we do appreciate this opportunity to release and present to you our report on conservation easements. Over the past 10 years, Minnesota state government has invested over $190 million in conservation easements. And with money available from legacy funds, that level of investment will probably continue. State money is used to purchase conservation easements to achieve a variety of objectives. For example, we purchased some conservation easements to help restore and protect habitat for wildlife, and other conservation easements to give anglers access to trout streams, and for a variety of other purposes as well. Conservation easements are an alternative to purchasing land outright. We essentially pay landowners to give us certain rights. Typically, they give up, for example, the right to control development and use of their land to a certain degree. In most cases, landowners are selling those rights to the state with the purchase of a conservation easement forever, that is, in perpetuity. Although there are, in some cases, conservation easements that are for a time-specific period. Today, the Office of the Legislative Auditor is releasing an evaluation report on how well the state is managing conservation easements. And our report has two major themes. First, conservation easements should not be treated like a passive investment. We should not simply do the deal and put the documents in a drawer. There should be active management of conservation easements through monitoring and oversight to ensure that the public objectives we are seeking with these investments are achieved. Second, a second theme in our report is that this active management should extend to our partnership with private nonprofit organizations. As you will hear in Ms. Randall's presentation, it is not just state agencies that are given state money to purchase conservation easements. The state also has granted money to private nonprofit organizations to purchase and maintain conservation easements. And like all partnerships, the state's partnership with these private nonprofit organizations must be based on a large measure of trust. But to ensure that that trust is maintained, there also needs to be some level of verification. In this case, verification that public money is being used prudently and for the purposes that align with state objectives. To tell you more about those two themes and other findings and recommendations, I'd like to call on Ms. Randall for a brief presentation. Madam Chair, and again, thank you.
Okay. There is a quorum now, and Representative Ward has obviously read every word of the minutes, and so he moves adoption of the minutes.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, and I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I'm pleased to be back in front of this committee, this time now to talk about our legacy amendment. That was last couple of weeks ago, our conservation easement evaluation. Before I get started on the conservation easement evaluation, I would like to acknowledge Julie Trupke, who's seated in the audience here, for her hard work on this evaluation. We did find some opportunities for improving oversight and accountability of conservation easements, and I want to just jump right into our key findings so you can get a sense of where we're headed. First, we found that nonprofit organizations are given a lot of discretion to identify property to protect the conservation easements, negotiate the terms of the easement agreements, and ultimately to acquire the conservation easements. We found that there's not adequate state requirements regarding monitoring the easements, you know, going out and visiting the property and making sure the landowner is complying with the terms of the easement agreement. We found that easement holders don't regularly measure the outcomes of conservation easements. And finally, there's some concerns out there about funding for stewardship, which involves monitoring the easements and enforcing the easements, and that funding for stewardship varies by easement holder and type. So I know I just threw a lot up there. I'm going to get into more of those in more depth and explain some of those terms. But first, let me take a step back, provide an overview of conservation easements, and explain a little bit more about how we got to those findings and then the associated recommendations. So first of all, conservation easements are a land protection tool, kind of similar to public ownership, except for conservation easements, the land stays in private ownership. It's a voluntary agreement between the private landowner and the easement holder, and this voluntary agreement limits the use of the land. As Mr. Nobles said, it may limit what type of building can happen on the land or whether farming can occur. In Minnesota, there are four main easement holders of state-funded conservation easements: the Board of Water and Soil Resources, BOWSER, the Department of Natural Resources, DNR. So those are the two state agencies that hold state-funded conservation easements. Ducks Unlimited and Minnesota Land Trust are nonprofit organizations that also hold state-funded conservation easements. Just to give you some sense of the scale, BOWSER holds about 5,200 conservation easements in the state, so about more than 80% of the state-funded conservation easements. That goes all the way down to Ducks Unlimited, that holds a total of 9 state-funded conservation easements. The state agencies hold by far the bulk of the state-funded conservation easements. From 2001 to 2011, the state spent $190 million to acquire, monitor, manage conservation easements. And currently, we have about 600,000 acres that are protected by 6,600 state-funded conservation easements. It's important to note that the number of easements, state-funded easements, has more than doubled over the last 10 years, and we anticipate that trend at least to continue somewhat, the growth in easements to continue somewhat, especially with the availability of legacy money. Just to make sure we're all on the same page about what a conservation easement is, I'm a big fan of this this metaphor, which is that a landowner's rights are like a bundle of sticks. So there's a stick associated with your right to build a house. There's a stick associated with your right to farm. There's a stick associated with the right to transfer ownership for your property. When a conservation easement is acquired, the landowner still holds some of his or her sticks, but some of those sticks are permanently removed and are extinguished as the result of the conservation easement. Conservation easements are said to have to run with the land, which means that these sticks continue to be removed from the bundle of rights whether or not ownership of the property changes hands. More than 95% of the state-funded conservation easements are perpetual, which means not only are these rights removed for the next landowner, but for the next and the next and the next into forever. That's what perpetual supposedly means. In Minnesota, there are more than 15 different types of conservation easements. I know that there's a lot of detail on this slide. On page 7 of your report, it provides more details on all 15 types of conservation easements. For our purposes, though, I just wanted to highlight that there are different types of easements and they have different purposes. So here I've highlighted two. One is the Reinvest in Minnesota, known as RIM Reserve easements. These are easements that are held by BOWSER, and their purpose is to remove farming, remove agricultural activity from certain parts of the land, and restore that land back to its natural characteristics. So the buffer strips along streams, for example, those are often rim reserve, protected with rim reserve easements. Contrast those to the wild and scenic river easements. Those are held by DNR. And those are easements along on property that are along rivers that are designated in law as scenic and wild rivers. And the purpose of those easements is simply to protect that property and keep it from having any future development. So again, those are just two easements, but you can see with the rim reserve easements there, we're doing some active management, taking the land that was farmed and restoring it to its natural characteristics. The wild and scenic river easements, in contrast, the land is already kind of still in its natural state, and we're preventing future development. So again, page 7 lists all of the different types of easements that we have in the state. When we set out to conduct this evaluation, we established a set of standards to use to evaluate how we're doing with conservation easements. Page 21 in the report, Exhibit 1.10, lists all of our standards, but we basically established standards for the whole life cycle of conservation easements, from how a piece of property is selected to writing the easement agreement to what type of monitoring and enforcement should happen. To develop our standards, we looked at federal standards, the standards developed by the state agencies and the nonprofit organizations and other national organizations. We used these standards to evaluate 127 state-funded easements that were held by these four easement holders. So now I'm going to get back to the findings I mentioned at the beginning and talk a little bit more about each of those. So the first finding is that the nonprofit organizations are given wide latitude to acquire state-funded conservation easements. Well, why is that a finding? Well, first of all, the nonprofit organizations are independent organizations. They're separate from the state. They have their own missions and their own priorities. Now, often their mission and priorities may align with the state's, but at the end of the day, they're their own organization. Having that, coupled with the fact that the appropriations language in recent years has often been quite broad. So what I put up here was some language in a 2012 appropriations bill that appropriated not quite $1 million to the Minnesota Land Trust to, you know, restore and enhance natural systems associated with the Mississippi, Minnesota, and St. Croix rivers. Well, that's about two-thirds of the state, and it doesn't really explain what we're hoping to accomplish with those conservation easements. So they're their own organization, again, often aligned with the state, but not always. We give them a significant amount of money without a lot of direction, and then we have limited state approval over the conservation easements that they enter into. DNR and Bowser have expertise to review easement agreements, but they don't have the authority to do so. And legislative staff for the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council and LCCMR also don't have the authority to approve the easement agreements that these organizations are entering into. So we have some recommendations related to oversight. First, we recommend that the legislature, as you're making your appropriations, you provide some more direction about what you're hoping to accomplish, some clear programmatic objectives about what you want to accomplish with the conservation easements you're asking folks to obtain on the state's behalf. We also recommend that Bowser or DNR have the authority and the responsibility to review and approve easement agreements in cases where there's a significant state investment. We've set the threshold here at $500,000 or more of state money, although, of course, that number is negotiable or at your discretion, clearly. And finally, we recommend that any nonprofit organization that holds state-funded conservation easements be accredited by the Land Trust Accreditation Commission. The Land Trust Accreditation Commission is a national organization that's really widely acknowledged to have kind of the gold standard for land trust organizations and conservation easements. Minnesota Land Trust, Ducks Unlimited, and the Nature Conservancy are already accredited by the Accreditation Commission and go through a rigorous reaccreditation process every 5 years. However, if there are other nonprofit organizations that are interested in participating in state-funded conservation easements, this would set a high bar for them to meet before they could participate in that.
Okay. Are there any besides these that are currently getting legacy funds? Are there any nonprofits that are not accredited that are currently getting legacy funds, or just ones that want to?
Madam Chair, members, there certainly are other nonprofit organizations that receive money from the legacy fund, but not for conservation easements.
Oh, okay.
Okay, our next set of recommendations and findings is related to monitoring. So what we found is that the state requirements for monitoring conservation easements are not adequate. Minnesota statutes do require monitoring for forestry easements, and only for forestry easements, but they do not establish a minimum frequency monitoring, a minimum frequency for which the monitoring should occur. There has been some recent appropriations language out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund money and the trust fund money that require a long-term stewardship plan, but again, there's no specifics about how much monitoring should occur. What's happened then is that each organization has developed their own standard. We developed a minimum consensus standard that easement holders should monitor the easements at least once every 3 years. So again, what I mean by monitoring is that the easement holder goes out to the property, maybe walks the perimeter, looks at aerial photos, something to look at the property and see whether or not the landowner is complying with the easement agreements. As part of our evaluation, we went out with each easement holder on a monitoring visit. So we were out in the prairie of Renville County on July 3rd, which I think was the hottest day of the year, looking at Rim Reserve easements. We looked at Wild and Scenic River easements with DNR. We looked at some wildlife easements with MLT, Minnesota Land Trust, and we looked at some shallow lake easements with Ducks Unlimited. So, you know, this is easement holders going out onto the property and, again, making sure that the landowner is complying with the terms of the easement agreement. So when we applied our standard of at least once every 3 years, we found that the easement holders had some mixed success. Ducks Unlimited and Minnesota Land Trust, for the easements that we reviewed, met our standard for 100% of the easements we reviewed there. In fact, they were visiting their easements annually for most of the easements that we reviewed. Bowser also met our standard with high success. 97% of the easements that they hold that we reviewed had been monitored at least once every 3 years. DNR struggled a bit more. 23% of the easements that DNR holds had met our had been monitored at least once every 3 years and met our standard. Now, there are some caveats for DNR. First, many of their easements are older, having been acquired in the 1970s and 80s, and the standards for monitoring were not quite as evolved, and they have done a better job recently in terms of monitoring and keeping up on their more current, more recent acquisitions of conservation easements. There are also certain types of easements that met our standards. So ACUB, which is the Army Compatible Use Buffer easements, those are the easements in a radius around Camp Ripley. All of those have been monitored at a level that met our standard. Same with the forestry easements. They had been monitored on an annual basis. And water bank easements also had met our standard. So we do have some recommendations related to monitoring. First, we think that the legislature should require all easement holders to have long-term stewardship plans, not just those that receive funding from certain pots of money. We also recommend that the legislature put in law that easement holders need to monitor their easements at least once every 3 years. And finally, we recommend regular reporting back to the legislature on monitoring activities. This would not only say, yes, you know, we're monitoring our easements, but what violations are we finding? When we were looking through the 127 easements, you know, we did find some violations that had been found by the easement holders. Most of them were minor, and there weren't that many, but this is still a relatively new instrument, and most people expect that as the land changes hands and the original landowner is no longer the person on the property, that violations may increase. So active monitoring is an important part of making sure that we limit the number of violations on property that is protected with a conservation easement. Moving on to the next set of findings and recommendations, just we found that
I know there was at least one question. Do you want to ask it now or wait?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I can throw it out there now. It's
okay.
Certainly relevant to a discussion of easements, and that is one of the things that you know, especially in rural Minnesota, we hear a lot about are, you know, the payment in lieu of taxes, the PILT payments, and wondering if you looked at that at all in connection with this.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl. We did look at the issue of appraisals and assessed value of property. See, I'm going to try and find it here on my... page 41 in the report starts our conversation about the assessed taxable values of property that have conservation easements on them. As you know, there is no form of PILT for property that's protected with conservation easements because conservation easements are still held by the private landowner who is still responsible for taxes on that property. So then the question comes into, well, how much has the property value changed as a result of the conservation easement, and then are those taxable values, are the taxes then from that property affected? We did meet with a group of county assessors, and there's also a 2007 Department of Revenue report that we found very useful. And basically, there's a couple of things that it comes down to. One is there's not a lot of information out there on which properties have conservation easements, and then the effect of a conservation easement on the taxable value. When you talk to the county assessors and others, you'll find that having a conservation easement on a property does not necessarily reduce the taxable value of that property. It may reduce the taxable value. It may leave it unchanged. It could even increase the value. And so right now what the state is facing is a lack of data, frankly, on what the effects of those easements are on taxable values. So we do have a recommendation in our report that Bowser and DNR together develop and maintain a database of conservation easements. So the first step, frankly, is finding out where do we have state-funded conservation easements, and then we also have a recommendation to get county assessors more information about where they're located so that we can start to figure out what the effect is. So we don't have a recommendation regarding, you know, PILT or a PILT-like instrument, in part because we simply don't know really what the effects are yet.
Okay.
A lot of talking.
All right. Representative Torkelson, you had...
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Randall, you've talked quite a bit about active monitoring of these public lands. Somebody has to fund that. Do you have any suggestions on how we create a mechanism to fund the active monitoring process?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes, we do. And as I get to that in my presentation, we'll be able to skip right over it because I'll just... do you want me to wait?
We can...
Okay.
Do it in order. That's
okay.
Fine.
I'll be getting to it. And then if you have more questions, please let me know.
Madam Chair, could I just mention...
Representative Hansen also had some...
Could I just mention on the PILT, though, and I think some of you may be aware of this, related to the land value issue. There is a major lawsuit which may shed some light as a result of the Blandon easement. There is a dispute currently in court as to whether or not that easement should have reduced the assessments on the property that was involved in that easement. That case is still pending, but I think what the court holds on that may shed some light, or it may be so specific to the facts of that particular property and easement that it may not. But I do think this is an issue that is going to develop over time. And we may come to a point where there is so much concentration of the use of conservation easements in certain areas, and that it has, in fact, reduced assessed values, that you will want to address the issue of PILT. I know that issue has been raised before and undoubtedly will be again.
Continue? Okay. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. The next set of findings and recommendations was about the outcomes of easements. And we found that easement holders really had limited measures of the outcomes of conservation easements beyond the number of acres protected. So while that's important to know the number of acres protected, if the ultimate purpose of the conservation easement is cleaner water or more wildlife, then simply knowing the number of acres isn't really going to tell us everything that we're hoping to get from the conservation easement. And frankly, the amount of public investment we're putting into easements warrants some demonstrated public benefit. We acknowledge that it's challenging to measure the effects of conservation easements. Certainly, you know, to measure the effect a single buffer strip has on the cleanliness of a given river is difficult. But there have been some recent studies that have been promising that have been able to evaluate the impacts of conservation easements. And we think that's really important, and we think it's something that easement holders really need to kind of keep at the forefront of their mind as they continue to acquire and manage conservation easements. So our recommendation to the legislature is to require easement holders to regularly report back to the legislature on what are we accomplishing with the conservation easements. Again, sometimes it's going to be challenging to be able to measure that. You know, what is the effect of keeping land that was in its natural state still in its natural state? That's a tough thing to measure. But if the legislature requires easement holders to regularly report on this and think on it, then we think that will help to heighten its importance, and hopefully folks will be able to demonstrate the outcomes of this investment. now Representative Torkelson getting to funding for stewardship. This was the last set of findings and recommendations I'll touch on. So we found that funding for stewardship varies by easement holder and type. And so stewardship involves the monitoring, that monitoring once every 3 years, and enforcement. So if there are violations, taking some action, whether that means negotiating with the landowner a resolution, all the way up to taking judicial action if necessary. What we found is the different easement holders have different access to this funding. So Bowser and DNR, they both receive a mix of general fund money, and then they get some dedicated state money. That's happened in more recent years through Outdoor Heritage Fund money. So they're getting some dedicated state money for stewardship purposes, but for older easements especially, the funding for that is still coming through general fund dollars. Minnesota Land Trust has a dedicated fund that it holds for stewardship purposes. So when it receives state money to acquire a conservation easement, it receives money to acquire the easement, and then it also receives a little bit of money, $18,000 to $20,000 per easement these days, and that money goes into a dedicated fund that it holds and manages, and then it must use that money for perpetuity to manage, enforce, and monitor those easements it holds. Ducks Unlimited currently does not rely on state money to fund its stewardship activities. Again, it has 9 conservation easements in the state, and it uses its membership dues and private donations and other funds to fund its stewardship activities. So with this different funding for stewardship, there's different access to money, and it may have an impact on the type of monitoring and enforcement that's happening for the different conservation easement holders. So we have some recommendations regarding stewardship funding. Really, our overall recommendation on this issue is that the legislature should consider some different options. We go through the report and lay out 5 different options for funding stewardship, but we don't recommend one over the other. They all have advantages and disadvantages. I'll go through them briefly here. Again, they're laid out in the report too, and certainly we can talk about any one of them in more depth if you're interested. So the first is, you know, the status quo is always an option. And again, it's working well for some of the easement holders, but it is creating some different levels of access for the funding. The legislature could establish a stewardship advisory committee. This would be run by a committee of stakeholders with expertise, perhaps some state agency staff as well. They would have access to a dedicated fund in the state treasury, and they would have some oversight authority and provide some expertise to the easement holders in terms of the stewardship being provided. Similar to the committee, but different, would be just a stewardship fund. It would be just a dedicated fund that the easement holders could have access to, receive reimbursement, basically, for their stewardship activities, but there wouldn't be the oversight or the expertise that would be involved in a committee. Another alternative is for the legislature simply to rely on the general fund appropriations every biennium. This would certainly give the legislature the most control and discretion in weighing the priority of conservation easement monitoring over other needs of state money each biennium. Of course, this would run the risk probably of underfunding conservation easement monitoring, and it would also provide a lot of uncertainty for easement holders in terms of how to manage their ongoing stewardship responsibilities. And finally, for the nonprofit organizations, the legislature could require them to use private funds, kind of leverage a private match of money to fund its stewardship funding. You know, the risk associated with that, of course, is that, again, monitoring may be underfunded, or it may serve as a deterrent for nonprofits to partner with the state on conservation easements. You know, I just want to reiterate that stewardship, the monitoring and the enforcement, is really a very important part of conservation easements. These are easements that we've put a public investment into to acquire them, and now there's this ongoing responsibility into forever to manage them. So the monitoring and enforcement is really a way to protect the state's initial investment. Representative Torkelson, if you have more questions on that, I'm happy to take them whenever.
Okay. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, what we've talked about quite a bit in the past here in regard to the legacy funds is whether or not it's appropriate to use the legacy funds for PILT or PILT-like payments. And it seems like many of the same questions would surround whether or not it's appropriate to use legacy funds for these ongoing monitoring requirements. You know, if we're going to continue to acquire lands with these funds, we're building the inventory in state, that's just responsibility of the state. So we're adding a burden to state government that needs to be met somehow. And I think this is the question we're wrestling with, and I'd like to hear your opinion.
Madam Chair, if I could weigh in on this, because I think there are a variety of factors. First point I think to be made is that the level and nature of the monitoring activities are going to vary, just like conservation easements do. You know, for a scenic easement, there may be simply a need for somebody to drive by and see that there's not something built there that it shouldn't be, that would violate the terms of the easement agreement.
Can we Google it?
We've seen the advance of things like aerial photography through Google Maps, and again, I think that will be a device that can be used, and also DNR does have a number of mechanisms that they can do aerial photography with. I would also say that for some organizations like Bowser, DNR, they have a lot of people in the field already. Obviously, DNR has got a lot of conservation officers that are in close proximity to much of the land on which we have purchased a conservation easement. And so I don't think there's going to be a huge amount of cost for a conservation officer to simply drive by to see if a road's been built. Now, depending on what the conservation easement is, you may need that conservation officer or even other people with some specific expertise to walk that land and know if there are any developments on that land, if there are species that we're trying to keep from that land. And so it may take a more detailed observation. But there can be a variety of ways in which we can leverage existing resources. I think one of the issues, too, is where will that, if we do stewardship appropriations, is it appropriate for that money to be held for work that is going to be in perpetuity? And I think we address that issue in the report. It is an issue that concerns some people more than others. I believe it is the Commissioner of Management and Budget issued a letter, a memorandum, saying that there was some concern in appropriating money to an organization, particularly a nonprofit, that they are not going to spend within the budget time frame that we normally work from, a biennial budget, that we may give them money that they say they need for the next 10 years, 20 years. I mean, again, one of the real challenges here is that many of these conservation easements are in perpetuity, and a lot of us don't have a lot of experience dealing with forever. But that's what these conservation easements are. And so exactly how much money you need to fund that activity forever is in itself a challenge to figure out. But how do you set up that fund for that particular easement that some amount of money will be there forever to engage in that activity? So, you know, we thought a lot about these issues, and I think, as Ms. Randall said, there isn't a perfect solution. I think any solution will have some benefits and some drawbacks. And maybe we don't come up with just one solution for all of these issues. Maybe it has to be addressed reflecting the specifics of the kind of easement that is involved, the kind of activities that are involved, and the kind of monitoring you expect. And just to touch again on one of the points that Ms. Randall made, and that is some of these easements are an attempt to reduce pollution into rivers and streams. And so some of them you may want and expect there to be some testing of the pollutants that are at some baseline in that stream and what we're doing with buffer strips to mitigate that. So that would be a much more complex, costly kind of monitoring that you may want and need to fund in a different way. So those are just a few additional thoughts.
Okay. One of the thoughts that I've had is for every grant that we give in every subject, putting some percentage of that, I've said this before in terms of geolocation of the property that the grant covers and so forth. One of the things we might also want to look at is some proportion of the indirect costs, in a sense, of the grant going to monitoring and so forth. I mean, if we want the legislative auditor to do more than they've done, which I'm pretty impressed with what they have done, but, you know, maybe we need to look at some uptick to their appropriation from these funds as opposed to the general fund.
Well, Madam Chair, I would just add in that regard of putting this on the Office of Legislative Audit,
I know.
The team will tell you that it was a highlight of their work to go out and do this monitoring of these easements. So, especially on that hot day in July. So, you're probably looking at the team that would take that on.
Well, you know, I just want members, I'm not putting a form proposal on the table, and I want members to think about that. Is that I think that as we move on, we've got to think about more than just giving the money and then letting it go out. We've got to think about kind of following up a little bit, following up on it. And I don't consider, even if you say, well, the legislative auditor is always supposed to do this stuff, I don't consider when we've increased their burden with doing a whole set of new things that's supplanting instead of supplementing. So I just, you know, this. A lot of imagination around this table, and I want other people than me just thinking about it. So that's a challenge that I throw out to you. Representative Hansen? And I'm sorry, I've done very bad time management of this committee for every meeting that we've had, and I do want to get on to the next subject. And I know that Bowser and DNR are here and so, but I think they'll be here very often throughout the rest of the legislative session. So I do want to just kind of quickly wrap this up and get on to our second subject. So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question, I was interested in what you said about the tax case going on, and that seems to come back to appraisals, and that the assessed value and the relationship between assessed value and appraised value, and maybe you covered appraisals a little earlier, but I was looking on page 39, and it talks about an entity sending a letter to the appraiser indicating the amount of funding available to purchase these. Can you maybe just talk about appraisals a little bit and what that really means? That you have in the report. And I know we're short of time, but I think it's an important piece.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, sure. As part of our review of easements, we looked in the file for how the easement was valued, whether it was by formula, which there's a statutory formula for a number of different types of conservation easements, or by appraisal, which is how easements are valued for those held by the nonprofit organizations and DNR. We were not qualified to judge whether or not an appraisal was accurate, but we did look to see kind of whether it was done and how it was reviewed. There was this one incident with Minnesota Land Trust where there was a letter in the file from a staff person at the organization to the appraiser saying the landowner's disappointed with kind of the initial value and this is how much money we have available. So it raised our eyebrows because it was an unusual letter, and we talked with them a lot, and they said it was an unusual letter also, and that they had a lot of problems with that appraiser. So I think there are, and so they felt that there needed to be a little bit more back and forth. But I think it raises the question of, frankly, oversight of the nonprofit organizations, and is part of what led us back to our recommendation for having some more state approval authority from DNR and Bowser to review the easement agreements, but then we also say that could be extended to reviewing appraisals. DNR has appraisers on staff, and they also have a whole internal review process for land acquisition or conservation easements for reviewing appraisals associated with those. And so part of our recommendation could easily be extended to including DNR's review and approval of appraisals of conservation easements acquired by nonprofit organizations.
Okay. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that you want to proceed with the next. So let me just put an issue on the table to be discussed as we go forward. We are not purchasing land or easements because we want 100 feet or 100 acres of concrete. We are purchasing essentially the biology. And so when we go back and look at that land, it is not to see whether there's necessarily a house on it or a road through it. Is what we purchased in the biology what we're still getting, which brings up the horrible issue of invasive species and the fact that some of these easements, or at least ones that I have read, do not have any language in it about invasive species. So somebody, I will use the Blandin one for example, you could purchase an easement, spend a lot of money for it, and in not too many years, it could be an invasive species haven. So those are some of the issues I think we need to address. It's a broader than just a drive-by shooting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Madam Chair, we will wrap up on that point, but I do just want to say I agree very much. Yeah. And we could possibly come back and explore with you in more detail what we saw in some of the easements, because we do have some concerns,
okay,
not only in what they sometimes lack, but also what they include in terms of the allowance of certain development on the land where there isn't going to be an easement. And so we think there ought to be full disclosure of that. I mean, we have done, Ms. Randall certainly and her team, did a fairly in-depth examination of the easements. And since, again, they are the contract by which we are spending public money, I think they would deserve a good deal of your attention, both what they lack and what they include.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative Ward, and then I'd like to move on. And, you know, I do think this is appropriate to put the questions on the table and that we'll let people think about them and then we'll come back and discuss them in greater detail.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be real quick. Mr. Nobles and Ms. Randall, you always whet our appetite for sure, and I appreciate that the work you do. And I have a number of questions, but I know, Madam Chair, that you want to get going, so I'm just going to make sure that I say something about the non-government organizations working with the agencies, working with the partners, and the work that they do in the state of Minnesota for conservation easement procurement. I'm glad that we're going to be able to discuss this further because I have a lot of questions about that, along with assessments and assessments versus Representative Hansen's question. I can't remember the word right now.
Appraisal,
yes, because we had some dialogue about that last year, I remember in particular. So I thank you for whetting our appetite, and there still are a lot of questions regarding this, and I just want to make sure that it's not completely off the table.
No. We will probably have these people back, and we'll certainly have the complete topic back. Back before us. Thank you very much. And I apologize to people who wanted a more thorough discussion of this. We do need to move on to the other half of our meeting. Okay, we'll let them. Okay, the next issue which has been brought to my attention from a lot of people and have also been brought to us, I hope to other members of the committee too, is the public comment on legacy funds and perhaps general funds. This is, we've talked vaguely about the arts at some point, but this is also a specific public problem that seems to be before us at this time, which is the issue of the Minnesota Orchestra and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And I wanted to, and you know, whenever I talk to someone, I realize that I know much less about this than I think I know from reading in the newspaper, reading newspaper articles, and reading people's comments to me. So, again, hopefully this is the start of our conversation on this to see if there's some role. The state, as I've pointed out, is a very large donor to some of these organizations, and see what our role can be as that donor. So, going to start now with the first person for comment. Is Michael Henson, who's the president and CEO of the Minnesota Orchestral Association. Mr. Henson, thank you. And you need to say who you are for the tape. And
Madam Chair and representatives, I'm Michael Henson, the president and CEO of the Minnesota Orchestra. thank you very much, and I very much welcome the opportunity to address you and answer any questions you have today. It is my pleasure to be here to represent the Minnesota Orchestra, which is an exceptional organization that has served this community with great music for 110 years. Our board is made up of citizen volunteers who are generous contributors to the orchestra. Speaking on behalf of the board and myself, we feel it is our responsibility and our privilege to ensure that the long legacy of this organization continues into the future, benefiting new generations of Minnesotans for years to come. We are grateful to the state of Minnesota and to the Legacy Committee for the annual operating support you provide to help make this possible. I know that it has been a point of concern from some legislators that the orchestra's yearly operating support from public monies might be used to fund our current negotiations or lockout. In order to eliminate all concerns around this point, we've sequestered in a separate account all state funds received to date in this fiscal year, and we will continue to do so going forward until we've reached a contract resolution. To be clear, no state funds have been or will be used to fund these negotiations. We will only access state funding once we have an agreement in place and we are again performing concerts for the community. As a non-profit, our orchestra has three sources of income. One, ticket sales from our concerts and events. Two, contributions from generous community members, corporations, foundations, and as I mentioned earlier, the state of Minnesota. And third, our endowment earnings. Over the years, generous donors have contributed to our endowment, and each year we're able to draw a percentage of those earnings to help sustain our operations. During the recession, each of our revenue streams were negatively impacted, particularly our contributions and investments. We maintained stability within the organization through these volatile years by relying on our endowment, which was the appropriate and responsible action, but it is not a sustainable one. Today, we face the reality that if we continue to draw down our endowment at our current rate, it will be depleted in 5 years' time. We cannot allow that to happen for the future of this organization. Last December, we announced a $6 million operating deficit for the orchestra. We know this deficit will continue to grow until we address our financial issues directly, and we have developed a thoughtful strategic plan to just do that. This plan calls for a combination of revenue increases, including our board members increasing their already generous contributions to the organization by 20%, as well as significant cost reductions, which we have already undertaken on the management and the administrative side of our operation.
Excuse me, Mr. Henson, did you give a dollar amount for the deficit?
The deficit is $6 million that we declared last year.
$6 million annually or $6 million over a longer period
of time?
It was
$6 million for last year's operating budget. Okay. Our education work is also central to the orchestra's purpose, and those issues are part of these talks too. We put forward a proposal to our musicians in these negotiations that would allow us the flexibility to dramatically increase the outreach work that the orchestra does in the community, both with students and adults. The proposal allows us to use our talented musicians even more so as our advocates in the community to perform educational and chamber concerts. In January, we put forth a four-point plan in order to restart our negotiations. Each point was designed to help eliminate any barriers that might stand in the way of the musicians putting forward a counter-proposal. We are now in a dialogue with the musicians about the terms around a joint independent financial review to verify the orchestra's financial position. We are hopeful that following this review, our players will make a counter-proposal and we can begin the type of two-way negotiations that will lead to a settlement and the resumption of our concert season.
Representative Murphy, did you have a question?
I had a question on the $6 million, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Hansen, is the $6 million include the expenses of the lockout?
The $6 million refer... Thank you, Madam Chair, representative, for the question. The $6 million refers to the previous year before the lockout was instigated, so it's last year's full operating accounts where we had a fully operating season. Before I close, I'd like to thank the legislator for the $14 million in bonding dollars you appropriated for the renovation of Orchestra Hall. That project is one of the major revenue-generating initiatives outlined in our strategic plan, and it is one of the fiscal solutions to our current financial challenges. The building project is on budget and on pace for our 2013 opening, and we are currently employing approximately 130 union members of the building trades as we speak. We thank you for making that possible. On a personal note, I would like to close by noting that I've worked for my entire professional career life managing symphony orchestras around the world. My family and I were drawn to Minnesota and to this great orchestra because of its outstanding reputation. Along with our board of directors, I see it as my duty to ensure that the Minnesota Orchestra remains artistically excellent and financially solvent for the future. Our sole purpose is to sustain an artistically excellent, fiscally solvent orchestra that benefits this community, its audiences, its supporters, and its musicians for many years to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Birdle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and first I'd like to thank you for coming here today and your presentation. I first saw the Minnesota Orchestra perform in 1970 at St. Cloud State University when I was a student there. That dose of culture had to hold me until a few years ago when I appreciate your outreach program. You came to Adassel Cokato High School and performed there. And I believe you've been there twice. I was at each time. Was able to visit a little bit with Osmo Vanska. My wife is of Finnish extraction, so there was a little rapport there, and we. Actually, we're in Finland at Sibelius. Is that the name of the?
Sibelius.
Well, we were there too, not for the performance of anything. Oh. But anyway, as I babble on a little bit about some personal history, I am concerned about this situation, and hopefully, a resolution can be reached soon. I don't know if there's any particular thing that. That we can do, but we are certainly interested in possible options. The specific question that I have is how much money has the strike or the lockout, I guess, cost you? How much does that cost the orchestra?
Well, Mr. Hansen. Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. We have three income streams, which are contributed revenue, which we continue to fundraise for. We have earned revenue, which is box office revenue, which we quite clearly are not collecting at the moment, and we are funding any tickets that we have sold. And we are still reliant on the investment income from the endowment. First of all, I want to say that we want to get the orchestra back to work as soon as possible. We want to negotiate a contract that is sustainable for this community with its generosity. And I think it's balanced on two occasions. The money that we haven't actually taken through obviously box office, and then the money that we haven't paid, unfortunately, because of the lockout. The reality is that we're trying to scope the size of the organization to the amounts of generosity we have. And the unfortunate thing is that for each month we played beyond the old contract that we had would have cost us, and we would have lost over $500,000 for each month we continued playing.
Okay.
Continue. Thank you, Madam Chair. One question then.
We will have response.
Regarding negotiations, have you been having regular sessions? Has there been a time period now when you haven't been meeting? What are the plans for future negotiations?
We had a meeting on the 2nd of January where we presented to the negotiating committee from both sides our financial plans going forward for the following 3 years. We changed the mission statement and we agreed to find common ground for joint financial analysis. Conversations have been going on for the last 6 or 7 weeks in terms of how to reach agreement on that financial analysis. So we are happy those conversations are going. We want to progress those as speedily as possible. I feel the details of the negotiations should probably be kept in the negotiating room, but we have every intent to try and move this forward as speedily as possible.
Final quick question. How long has this been going on?
We locked out the orchestra on the 1st of October, so we are into the fifth month of this lockout. We realized this was going to be a complicated negotiation, which is why we presented our first proposal on the 12th of April, giving nearly 6 months for us to have conversations. We are still waiting to have our first counterproposal from the musicians. We see by removing the barriers that apparently were there in terms of what I said earlier about the 2nd of January, that hopefully those are removed and we can actually move to substantive negotiations as soon as possible.
Okay, we do go to Representative Hausman and then Freiberg, and we really do have a long list of people who want to say something, so we'd like to get to them. Plus, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Henson. It was a long time ago that you and I met, and I have lots of questions. But the presentation still sounds very much the same after so much time, and it sometimes feels to us as sort of a cold description of a balance sheet. And what I hear in the community, and maybe what we represent, is this growing sense of urgency and loss and despair. This committee is about preservation of the arts, among other things, over and above what this community and this state usually did. That's what people voted for when they voted for the amendment, and so we those are the kinds of contributions we make. And I think this feels to so many in the community like the opposite of preservation of the arts, the destruction of the arts by people who...
You know, I know people would like to respond, but we really get a better meeting going if we allow statements to be made without audience reaction. So I'll just ask people to refrain from that in the future.
And it's by people who love the arts. By people who are devoted to it. But there is this sense of disbelief growing in the community as time passes by and nothing changes. The presentation doesn't change. The words are still the same. And the one thing that haunts me in the words is, as I think about this, the coincidence of timing of this lockout with the construction that feels sort of convenient. It's a good time to have a lockout when there is construction, especially when I heard you say we really save money with the lockout. If we were playing, we would be losing money every month. And so I think it's, as we've heard these words, this troubling dimension to this, the timing of it. We've heard some of the descriptions of, Do we have a surplus that that shows donors we are comfortable, or do we have a deficit that explains a lockout? So it's this sense of loss and despair that the community feels, this sense of urgency, and yet it doesn't feel as though that's a shared feeling.
Madam Chair, representatives, thank you very much for the question. We are a performing arts company, a great orchestra. The board's intent is to get the orchestra playing concerts, giving education work as soon as possible. But we need to do that from a sustainable base. We're 110 years old, and we have the duty to make sure that this orchestra continues for another 110 years. So we have a substantial financial challenge that needs to be overcome. We have to address that. But behind that is a passion for the arts, for music, that everybody on the board, everybody inside the company and the community feels. It's in everybody's interests to get the orchestra back on stage as soon as possible, but it has to be at a level that actually is sustainable, and it is at a level that this community is able to both afford and generously gives to.
Okay, I'd like to go to Representative Freiberg, then I'd like to hear to some of the other people on the...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this very quick. Okay. We heard a little bit about what the lockout is allegedly costing the organization. I'm wondering what the lockout is costing the average musician in the orchestra, say a second violinist who just started working there recently.
Madam Chair, Representative, the current average salary that we had in the previous contract was $119,000. The current average salary that we have before negotiating any further is $89,000, with $30,000 on average in benefits. So that we're no longer obviously paying that salary and those benefits, that is the cost to the musicians. We are very aware of that. We want to resolve this as speedily as possible in terms of how we can get everybody back to actually creating music.
Okay, and I'll just add, I don't think we'll have numbers on this, but there's an obvious cost to both. Remember, we do have two musical groups we're talking about. There's obvious cost to both the city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul for this. Okay, well, I hope you'll stay around for the rest of the meeting. We'll continue with some other people. Thank you very much for coming.
Madam Chair, representatives, thank you for allowing me to testify.
Okay. Okay. The next person on our list is Kathy Schubilski. Apologize if I've mispronounced words. Schubilski, the violinist of the Minnesota Orchestra, and some musicians from the orchestra. And each of you should say your name for the tape and identify yourselves.
I'm Douglas Wright. I'm the principal trombonist of the orchestra, and I've been in the orchestra for 18 years.
Okay.
I'm Anthony Ross, principal cellist of the orchestra. I've been a member of the orchestra for 24 years.
And I'm Kathy Schubilski, a violinist with the orchestra. I've been with the orchestra for 12 years, and I'll be speaking on behalf of the musicians today. Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak today. On behalf of all the musicians, please accept our deep gratitude for the exceptional support for the arts that Minnesotans offer through the Legacy Fund and for your work to oversee it. Musicians of the Minnesota Orchestra are proud to be part of the state's largest arts institution, and we're thrilled that Minnesotans' commitments to the arts makes them a cornerstone of our quality of life here. In 2012, the Minnesota Orchestra Association received nearly $1 million from the State Arts Board in legacy funding. The legacy fund support, the $97 million that our board volunteers have raised through this recession, and the institution's large endowment, the sixth largest in the United States, all speak to the value Minnesotans place on having great orchestral music played by a home team. Yet the organization receiving this funding is offering no music of any kind this season. The current leadership's imposed lockout threatens the quality and quantity of music. The latest round of announced cancellations through April 7th brings the total withdrawn educational concerts to 18. The musicians have been locked out with no pay or benefits. Yet the building project continues, and management continues to hire employees to staff a building rental business. We believe that the state's significant investment deserves financial transparency. We are grateful for state leaders like you who are looking into both legacy funding and the state bonding. The musicians have been overwhelmed with the deep public support and enthusiasm shown at the few concerts we've been able to produce this season. These concerts have included neighborhood and community concerts at the Lake Harriet Bandshell, at the North Minneapolis Y, Colonial Church in Edina. We also produced successful season opening concert at the Convention Center, concerts at Ted Mann Hall just before Christmas, and recently were invited to play at the Mayor's Grammy Celebration Concert. Tomorrow night, we will be playing a benefit for students of the first El Sistema class in North Minneapolis. El Sistema is a program that seeks to build community and opportunity through free music education for at-risk school children. We are deeply committed to playing not only inspiring music in the concert hall, but to sharing it with our students and citizens of Minnesota and as well as beyond state borders. In 2010, the orchestra was hailed as the greatest orchestra in the world by New York critic Alex Ross after a Carnegie concert conducted by Osmo Venska. The Minnesota Orchestra was the only North American orchestra invited to the prestigious Proms Festival in London that year, and recordings of Beethoven and Sibelius are received with critical acclaim. Yet, despite all of this success, for the past four seasons, the management has reduced the number of concerts we offer at home. When there are less concerts, there is less revenue. When there's less revenue, the endowment has to be drawn from more heavily. In spite of all the success, the marketing budget was reduced as well. We have heard of the management's desire for more education and outreach. We agree with this. We're very puzzled that for the past four seasons, several weeks were left unscheduled each year. This is essentially musicians being paid to stay home and no concerts are produced. Musicians approach the management with specific ideas for outreach and education concerts. The answer to each suggestion was no. We estimate the cost of these wasted services at $2 million over the past 4 years. The rationale seems to be a supply and demand theory, apparently from the airline industry. Unfortunately, this experiment has not resulted in increased revenue or capacity sold. In fact, our capacity sold has not increased, we believe, due to a diminished presence in our community. If we fail to promote our own art form of world-class performances of great music, people will find other venues and interest in which to invest their time and money, and the orchestra will begin on a downward spiral of less relevance and success in the community. This is not happening everywhere across the country. In fact, this month's Help Wanted ads for orchestral musicians includes 24 positions in other orchestras. We are deeply concerned that these orchestras in states which supply much less art support than Minnesota will be filling their openings with our players. We believe the model of less music and fewer musicians is contrary to the spirit of legacy funding. The musicians look forward to more community outreach, not less, reaching more children, not fewer, and living up to the Minnesota Orchestra's mission of delivering, performing, and inspiring performances of great music. The musicians of the Minnesota Orchestra couldn't be more grateful to the state for its tremendous support. It's living up to this every day that challenges us to the level of excellence Minnesotans expect in the arts, and that we feel our state deserves. It gives us hope for the kind of thriving musical organization we think this state expects. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments from either of the other?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm hoping that the Mr. Hansen, I see him here still, so I might get another question for him later, but can you tell us, in previous contracts, have you made some concessions and salary-wise, benefit-wise, and what has that amounted to?
I'll let my colleagues who are present at those concessionary contracts speak to that.
Yes, after the recession hit in 2008.
As you speak, say who you are.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, Anthony Ross. Thank you, Representative, for the question. This is Anthony Ross. This contract that finished last October when the lockout began was a five-year agreement. In the, I believe, the second year of the agreement, right after the recession, we did reopen, and we gave back over $4 million in concessions to try to help with the crisis.
I've got a couple questions, but I'll just do one more follow-up if I can, Madam Chair. What's the, Madam Chair, just one more?
Yeah.
So what's the current status? What is asking of you currently to be negotiated to from the, what's the current proposal?
I'm Douglas Wright, the principal trombonist. The current proposal on the...
Say who you are.
I'm Douglas Wright.
Okay.
I'm the principal trombonist. The current proposal on the table right now calls for anywhere from 30 to 50% pay cuts to each of the musicians, drastic cost shift in medical health care costs from the employer to the musicians, over 40 years worth of working conditions removed. What am I missing? Reduction of numbers of musicians. Essentially, will take us. This orchestra has spent the better part of its 110-year history among the top 10 orchestras in this country, and this proposal will take us outside of the top 10 by quite some distance, putting a number of orchestras in front of us that have never been before us.
And Madam Chair, I heard Mr. Hansen say that they have also done some cuts. Have they done equal cuts to the management level as well?
Yeah, this is Anthony Ross. Again, I think that's a better question for the managers themselves.
I agree. Thank you.
Okay, we'll get to that. Representative McDonald.
Madam Chairman, question for the testifier. You mentioned that you received $1 million from Legacy. Is that just for the fiscal year of 12-13?
Thank you. Yes, that was just for fiscal 2012.
Why don't we have Ms. Roberts say something about the funding? Because I think we're adding this general fund from the Arts Board plus Legacy. So,
Madam Chair, you do have a spreadsheet in your packet that was provided by the State Arts Board. Ms. Jens put this together for us. And you'll see in fiscal year 2012, according to the State Arts Board, the total funding for the Minnesota Orchestra was just over $1 million, and of that, $693,000 was from the legacy funds.
Okay. Yes, thank you very much. Small writing, so I guess I'll bring my glasses next time.
I should have pointed it out.
I did see it earlier, but I wrote notes on the back.
Okay.
And then to the testifier, you mentioned the funds from donors, the endowments. You mentioned the number, but I don't want to repeat it for fear that I got it wrong. Could you mention that number again?
Yes, and I'd like to recognize some of our wonderful volunteer board members who are here today who have done an amazing fundraising job that since the recession began, they have raised $97 million for the Building for the Future campaign. We have deep respect for our music-loving board members who have undertaken this fundraising.
Madam Chair, I thought that was a number that I wrote, that $97 million. So that's for a building project. Does that not cover... How does that help the musicians at all?
You might want to ask the management, but it is allocated to the building. It's allocated to the building, as well as to a portion to the endowment and a portion to artistic initiatives.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay.
I just was Googling the success of orchestras in the United States. We are in a great recession. We're just coming out of it. Some good news. So I would imagine, I presumed incorrectly, I imagined that perhaps the attendance is down in orchestras throughout America. Perhaps that's why management wisely has to cut and find ways to save money so they can survive. And we all have to take part in the responsibility of that, from the violinists to the lawmakers to those who love attending such events, such as Rep. Erdahl and myself and many others. So we all share in the sacrifice, and I hope that your labor group is seeking solutions to help be part of the solution, not the problem. But I did notice that Ohio's Orchestra has record ticket sales. And there were several others that I was just Googling, and the power went out. So unfortunately, such is the nature of technology. So I'll have to use my memory. So it appears that in times, tough times, we can gather together and come up with solutions to have record ticket sales and do what you need to do to survive. But I'm curious, although most of the funding is from donors and other areas, not necessarily the legacy committee, the taxpayers, what do you want us to do here on this side as policymakers?
Thank you. We're very grateful for your question and grateful to Madam Chair for inviting us to speak today. We really appreciate the state being interested in the financial transparency of the Minnesota Orchestra Association, especially as regards to the investment of state bonding and legacy money. And musicians have been requesting an independent financial analysis to that end for many months now, and we are 5 months into a lockout and has not appeared.
Okay. Well, I do want to try and see if for first we can get through everyone that's listed on the program. So we will, and hopefully we'll have some other chance for people to answer questions too. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
And let's hope you'll hang around and we'll be able to get back. Okay. Next, Paulo Dacos, the co-chair of Orchestra Excellence. Is that person here? Okay, yes. Again.
Paula Dacos and Lori Greeno, the other co-chair of Orchestrate Excellence.
Okay.
Chair Kahn, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you for considering the Minnesota Orchestra and SBCO lockouts in light of the taxpayer funds those organizations receive, including grants from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund of the Legacy Amendment. I'm Paula Dacos, co-chair of Orchestrate Excellence.
Lori Greeno.
Lori Greeno is here too, the other co-chair. We are an independent coalition of over 1,000 community members, donors, concert goers, and organizations giving voice to the economic, educational, and artistic repercussions of the Minnesota Orchestra lockout. New groups are joining each week, evidence of the deep impact the Minnesota Orchestra has had on the community and what we're missing this year. Although economic activity may not be the direct purview of this committee, it's important to understand that aspect of the lockouts. Millions of dollars in revenue have been lost, wages cut or jobs lost in restaurants, parking ramps in the Minneapolis Convention Center, and school programs impacted. Our testimony before the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee outlined these impacts in detail, and copies have been provided to each of you. The Minnesota Orchestra is exactly the kind of institution the Legacy Amendment was intended to support, helping to attract families to our state to live and learn, run businesses, and raise families. The orchestra has been built over decades through tickets purchased by hundreds of thousands, taxpayer dollars, individual gifts large and small, and the hard work of Minnesota Orchestra musicians, artistic directors, and staff. We can be justifiably proud of what we have created together. The Minnesota Orchestra is not only an artistic jewel, but also an important asset and economic driver for our state. At least $2.6 million in taxpayer funds were granted to the Minnesota Orchestra via the State Arts Board to be used during the 2011-12 and 2012-13 seasons. The orchestra describes specific goals and outcomes for these grants, including to provide audiences with the highest possible level of musical performances, to design programs to reach our community through performances outside of Orchestra Hall. We absolutely agree that the orchestra has done a superb job of reaching those goals in prior years, in concert with what the Legacy Amendment envisioned. In the 2011-12 season, educational programs reached 50,000 students. The orchestra spent a week in Willmar as part of their Common Chords initiative, and tens of thousands thrilled to performances in person. But the 2012-13 season has brought silence. We must work towards resolution. The Arts and Cultural Heritage 25-year framework called us not merely to sustain, but to bolster Minnesota's reputation as a center for creativity, innovation, and imagination. The Minnesota Orchestra is perhaps a leading example of what the amendment was meant to foster across the arts and cultural scene. An orchestra which has gained national and international renown from its tours, recordings, and broadcasts, repeatedly lauded by critics as the greatest in the world. Let's not let it implode. All constituencies, board and management, musicians, and the community need to work together to find a way to continue to build this tremendous asset, not dilute it to mediocrity. We must look to the future. The Minnesota Orchestra has been a core component of our rich artistic culture for 110 years. And we are convinced that it can be and will be again. Our first priority should be to get the orchestra playing again. We ask both sides to rededicate themselves to finding a mutually satisfactory resolution, if only an interim solution, such as play and talk, while productive negotiations continue. Productive dialogue must begin now. When people from other states find out what is happening to our orchestra, they are incredulous. That can't happen in Minnesota, they say. Minnesota is better than that. We believe that is true, and that working together, we Minnesotans can find a way out of the current impasse. Let us gather the best creative minds from all the orchestra stakeholders, board, musicians, and community, to chart a new path forward. We need to take into account the financial challenges facing the orchestra and the social, demographic, and technological changes that are transforming our world. But we need to use all the imagination and creativity at our disposal to craft a new vision for our state's largest arts institution, a future that preserves its artistic brilliance. If there is any community and state that can do this, we believe the Twin Cities and Minnesota can. We know orchestras in similar metropolitan areas are finding new paths to success, creating innovative programming, raising new donations, and providing salary agreements that ensure their musicians stay. We, the community members, music lovers, attendees, and donors, want to be involved in finding a solution that works in Minnesota. We want to find a solution that preserves our artistically excellent orchestra. We've worked together to create the Minnesota Orchestra we have today. Let's work together to create the Minnesota Orchestra that continues through the 25 years of the Legacy Amendment and beyond. Thank you.
I'm sorry, we are really getting short on time, and I would like to have an opportunity for the people from the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra to come up. I will probably have another meeting on this subject, and maybe we'll have some committee members starting to think about some things to put on the table for solutions. So I would like to at least get, if the three people listed from the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, Carol Mason Smith, Marielle Jacobson, and Elmer Pierre could all come up together and start. By the time this session is over, hopefully I'll get the scheduling in shape. So. But I would at least like to get this issue on the table also. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Mason Smith. I'm a musician with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra and co-chair of the Musicians Negotiating Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. This is the second time in the past month I've sat before state lawmakers to discuss the impact this lockout is having on our lives, our loyal audiences, and our community. With 30 years of experience with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, I'm used to performing, but frankly, this is an unfamiliar stage. I'm not completely comfortable in front of you, but I am convinced that it's critical I'm here today to tell you about our labor problems and their impact, particularly because our ensemble is supported by the state and funded in part by the Legacy Amendment. First, musicians of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra are very grateful for your interest in the current challenges we face. We are hopeful that just being here today will help raise awareness and help us get back to work, get back to doing what we love, and that is playing world-class orchestral music for Minnesotans. Over the years, we've had our share of contract challenges with the management, but working collaboratively, we were always able to overcome our differences. Unfortunately, that is not the case today. We are sad, we are disappointed, and we are frustrated by the negotiations. In addition to giving back more than $2 million in salary concessions over the last 10 years, we have made several concessionary offers, including our latest, our fourth proposal, delivered to the management on January 22nd. Our proposal provides substantial savings through 2016 through salary and musician cuts. Had the management agreed to our proposal, we estimate we could have saved $4.6 million over the next 3 years, which includes $1.2 million now being saved by this lockout. Instead of seriously considering our proposal, they have ignored it. And in fact, this interim management's proposal has not substantially changed since September 7th, 2012. This interim management's response has been to continue to cancel concerts now through March 23rd, which decreases their costs but increases the damage done to our musicians and their families. In 2012, close to $500,000 in Legacy Amendment funds were allocated to the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, with the intent to support their organizational goals and objectives. Those goals and objectives are expressed in the mission of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and I quote, to present a world-class professional chamber orchestra in the Twin Cities dedicated to superior performance, artistic innovation, and education for the enrichment of community and world audiences. Based on the current management's actions, we don't envision the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra achieving these goals and objectives in the future, and that is unfortunate. Instead, our musicians deal with the harsh realities of a lockout. Even after we have agreed to play more concerts and be paid less, that's not enough. Management wants more concessions. They want fewer musicians, more artistic control, and lower salaries. Combined, these changes could cut the heart out of this orchestra. Musicians have offered to go from 34 to 28 players, but only if the management commits to giving us a real voice in decisions about the rebuilding of our complement. Having no background or experience, this interim management does not have the ability to make those decisions alone without musician oversight. The ability to recruit and retain world-class musicians will be impossible without musician oversight. As of today, we've been locked out for 113 days. During that time, we've spent many hours in the state of Minnesota's unemployment offices. We've spent a great deal of time looking for new jobs and even for new careers. Several of us are no longer working as professional musicians, and some of us have sold our homes and moved out of the community we love. I speak for all SPCO musicians when I say we want to be part of the solution. We want the management to end this lockout while we continue to talk through contract differences. And finally, we want to return to a stage we're all comfortable on, one where we make music for our loyal audiences rather than make speeches for elected leaders. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this time and this opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other comments?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Mary Ellen Jacobson, and I am the chair of Save Our SPCO, a group of audience advocates seeking to bring an end to the destructive lockout of SPCO musicians. I grew up in Duluth, but have lived in the Twin Cities ever since my college years, and as a matter of fact, I first heard the SPCO when I was in college and was able to get free front row tickets to some of their concerts at the O'Shaughnessy. It was well worth the neck cramps that I got that I sustained from sitting so close. I've been a huge fan, a ticket buyer, and a contributor ever since. I'm also an amateur French horn player who has played in various community orchestras around town for 40 years. So I know something about the incredible amount of work it takes to make even passable orchestral music. And I know something about the complex ecosystem of professional, amateur, and student orchestras in the area, all of which are extremely valuable to our community. And I can testify to the enormous value of having world-class musicians in our community who are available and willing to conduct or coach or teach those of us who play for the pure pleasure of experiencing from the inside the greatest music ever written. The Save Our SPCO group was started in late October by a few audience members who were very disturbed over the lockout of the musicians. It has grown to a core group of about 45 people and at least 2,500 people who follow and support our activities via our e-newsletter and our website and our Facebook, and who have signed a petition calling for an end to the lockout, and who have responded to a survey on ticket prices and contributions that we sent out 10 days ago. Even more individuals have attended concerts produced by the locked-out musicians themselves. There was a Mozart concert with Pinka Zukerman. There's a Messiah concert with Hugh Wolf and the Minnesota Chorale and soloists from the Minnesota Opera. And most recently, there was an Italian Baroque Concerti concert featuring brilliant soloists from within the ranks of the orchestra performed without a conductor. We in SOSPCO have assisted with the logistics and publicity for these concerts, and it's been a thrill for us to make and strengthen our own personal relationships with these wonderful musicians. Revenues from these concerts have gone to the musicians and are used to pay concert expenses, although performers and venues have very generously contributed some of their time and facilities. And those revenues also help pay for other things, such as the musicians' legal counsel, PR materials, etc. SOSPCO seeks to provide a voice for fellow audience members who do not want to see this priceless and unique community treasure, so many years in the making, destroyed. We do not want to see these brilliant musicians move away or being forced to find other work. We do not want the ripple effects of empty concert halls to harm workers in service and support industries. We hope to inform and mobilize the wider community about the issues and about the need to bring this destructive lockout to an end. We also hope to help in very practical ways. Just yesterday afternoon, we presented our research, findings, and recommendations to some board and staff members of the SPCO. Our primary recommendations were to raise ticket prices and for SPCO to partner with us, SOSPCO, to raise about $750,000 in new contributions from the grassroots supporters of the orchestra. SPCO's ticket prices are the lowest of any orchestra in the United States. Well, maybe in the world, but of any professional orchestra in the United States. 95% of the 570 people who responded to our survey just a week ago said they would gladly pay higher ticket prices to prevent the extinction of this orchestra. We realize that about $840,000 in legacy funds were granted to SPC over the last 3 years to help underwrite these underpriced tickets, so the situation is complex. But we still believe that the market would bear higher ticket prices, and the SPCO could use future legacy funds, should they be granted, for other projects in the years ahead. We are absolutely in favor of marketing programs that would make these brilliant performances of the SPCO available to people of all income levels, but we aren't convinced that across-the-board rock-bottom ticket pricing is the way to go. We look forward to partnering with the SPCO management in a campaign to raise $750,000 in new grassroots contributions, the purposes of which would be to prevent the draconian cuts to the musicians' salaries that Carol just mentioned, and also to allow the orchestra to remain at 34 positions. Hopefully, we can start planning this effort in the next week or so, but its success will hinge on ending the lockout. As the great Abe Lincoln would say, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, we thank you for giving us the time to share our perspectives and concerns. Yesterday's presentation to the SPCO management can be found on our website, as can much more research, audience feedback, essays, and event information. That site is www.sospco.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Last person, you have some comments. And we're already over our time, and people are starting to come in. And my apologies for the bad schedule.
Madam Chair, members of the committee and staff, I want to thank you for hearing us out. And all I'm going to do is quote Mickey Mantle at a House hearing where he said, vis-a-vis his manager, I agree pretty much with what Casey said. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you all. Are there any quick questions for committee members? And again, we'll, Representative Wills, again, we will be continuing this discussion. I don't want to stop it here, but we, so.
Thank you, yeah. Madam Chair. It's more of a comment, really. I just wanted to say I really appreciate everyone coming in on this issue and wanted to say that my first date with my now husband was at a St. Paul Chamber Orchestra concert. Oh. So I'm looking forward to digging into this a little bit more, and I hope that we can focus on how it pertains to the legacy funding that we provide and how we can help in that way. Thank you.
You know, that was one of the issues that I wanted to get to, which we obviously can't get at the level of this discussion, which is what can we do to use legacy funding to either the legacy funding that's sequestered this year, which hasn't been spent, or the legacy funding which we're looking at it doing in the future. And is there some package we can put together that looks at, you know, one of the things I haven't heard of and heard from and maybe we should talk is, are there contributions, as we've talked about the penalty to the cities, you know, are there contributions from the cities that could be possible to fix this and so forth? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Madam Chair, as a question for next time again, but one of the contributions of state taxpayers was bonding dollars, and what I don't understand and would like an answer to is
that's for the orchestra.
Mr. Yeah. Henson said that there was a substantial financial challenge, and that was a quote. And I was wondering if he was aware of this challenge when he asked for bonding money, and if he was aware of it, did he share it with the bonding committee?
Okay. Well, Mr. Henson, can you answer that one quickly, and then I know we're beyond our time and we're going to have Representative Mullery in here yelling at us, but let's try and as I said, we'll probably schedule another meeting. The first thing I looked was to see if all the bonding money had gone out yet, see if we had any hook on that, but it had.
Madam Chair, representatives, when we applied for the money, the economy was in a turbulent position. We were using the endowment to stabilize the organization. We undertook a strategic planning exercise after we received the money, and no one at that stage realized how volatile the economy was going to be and whether it would return quickly or slowly. Unfortunately, it turned much more slowly than we expected. And we began our strategic planning after we had received notification of the funding in January 2010.
Representative Lilly.
I think
Representative Wagenius is not satisfied with that answer,
I think specifically
she was asking what was told to the bonding committee. But
that's right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We explained to the bonding committee at that time we were operating from a stable financial basis, that we had presented 3 years of operating balances. We had done that, and in the short term we were operating from a stable basis. Part of that stability was how do we manage the five-year contract that we have with our musicians through to 2012.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the testifier. There's quite a few of us that serve on both capital investment and this legacy committee, and I think I just want to share Chair Hausman's comments. I really and disappointed in your legacy you're leaving for Minnesota and going forward, and I really challenge you to settle. I just think it's really unfortunate, and it'll certainly be an impact my decisions as I vote on capital investment and legacy in the future. So,
Representative Erdl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quickly, and I serve on capital investment as well as this committee, and I'm struck that, you know, with our athletic teams and everything, you know, ticket sales seem to have, for the most part, gone up, except for the Twins, and that's another reason. But what have ticket sales done as far as your concerts?
Madam Chair, representatives, ticket sales last season continued to show a slight decline in classical sales. Pops sales remained very stable. It's also important to remember, in terms of the number of concerts that we give, that in terms of Summerfest, we actually saw an increase in our ticket sales as well.
I'd just like to say quickly, in light of the performances of our athletic teams, it really is appreciative that we have at least something in this state that has been number one, and please try to remain the high level.
Okay, we've got to get
Mr. Hanson,
Representative Ward.
Real quick, because I had asked a question of the previous testifiers about the cuts that they took. What percent of cuts, and they suggested I ask you, what percent of cuts have you as a management level taken? I heard 30 50% from them. What have you taken percent-wise?
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, we are in a stage of negotiation, so whatever the cuts that we actually finally agree, we've not agreed as part of that negotiation process with the musicians. We have effectively frozen salaries across the administration for the last 5 years, while the musicians have received a 19% increase. We've cut pension contributions by 40%. We've laid off 20% of the management, and medical costs are cost the staff 25% more than they currently cost the musicians.
I'm not sure. Okay, I'll leave it at that.
Representative Freiberg, quickly, and then...
Sure. I just wanted to second what Representative Lilly said. I find this whole process very dispiriting. When I was in high school, I thought about... I played the piano. I thought about becoming a musician, but I decided, you know, I could practice 8 hours a day and still not be guaranteed of being... having a reasonable career with reasonable hours, so here I am at this job. So instead, I'm part of what Ms. Jacobson referred to as the complex ecosystem of amateur musicians, which I enjoy a great deal. But I do find this whole process dispiriting, well, and I would like to see it resolved and
okay.
Influence
We've
how I vote on this
bunch
committee.
More people into thinking about it, and I think we need to think about what we can do to advance. Thank everyone. Meeting adjourned. Thank everyone for coming.